Thank you. I'm very happy to be here this afternoon to introduce the WHO Global Code of Practice on the International Recruitment of Health Personnel. I'll try to be mercifully short. In the few minutes I have, I'd like to briefly describe how this groundbreaking legal instrument provides an international architecture for global cooperation on issues of health worker migration and recruitment. And then I'm also going to discuss some of WHO's strategies to implement the code and some of the key challenges that it's facing. So as Karen mentioned, I need to disclose, of course, that I work with WHO on the negotiation of the code. WHO asked me to be here today, but I'd also like to point out the views that I am expressing today are my own and should not necessarily be attributed to WHO. Well, we've heard a lot from the previous speakers about the global challenges of health worker migration and recruitment. So I don't want to belabor this, especially as I'm not the economist in the room, but I just want to make a few points. According to WHO, 57 countries now face critical shortages of health workers. We've heard a lot about the challenges facing the Caribbean, but of course the challenges are global. According to WHO, the shortfalls of health workers are greatest in sub-Saharan Africa, which is the recognized epicenter of the global health workforce crisis. According to WHO, sub-Saharan Africa now bears 24% of the world's disease burden, but is only 3% of the world's health workers and less than 1% of the world's financial resources. And of course, as Malvina described, there are significant push and pull factors in the migration and recruitment challenge, particularly between low and high-income nations. You know, we see aging populations in rich countries, increased specialization of health services, as well as emerging hubs of healthcare delivery, such as in the Gulf states in Southeast Asia. Those are all driving up the demand for health workers globally. So these and other pull factors, such as targeted recruitment efforts from wealthy destination states, combined with push factors, such as low wages, poor and dilapidated health systems, issues of conflict, and unstable working environments, all pushing this trend of health workers moving from low-income countries to high-income countries worldwide. And finally, of course, we should point out that the challenges of health worker migration are not only among nations, but within nations. In almost all countries, rural areas face far worse shortages than urban areas. So moving on to the code, in order to advance a framework for global dialogue and cooperation on health worker migration issues, in 2004, the World Health Assembly, which is now the 194 member state governing body of WHO, adopted a resolution calling for the Director General to develop a non-binding global code of practice in consultation with member states and relevant partners. I think notably, this process was preceded by a number of unsuccessful initiatives to address the challenges of health worker migration and recruitment on a country-by-country or on a multilateral basis. Examples of these include, of course, the Pacific Code of Practice and the Commonwealth Code of Practice. And those initiatives were considered unsuccessful for two key reasons. One is they were, and Christoph, listen to this, they were regional solutions to a global problem and could only address this issue in respect in a piecemeal way. The other key reason why such initiatives from a legal perspective were regarded as unsuccessful is that they didn't include none of these instruments included any mechanisms to encourage states to implement the norms that were included in them. So the WHO code was negotiated over 2 years, and it was formally adopted on May 21st of last year, following a marathon 3-day negotiation session that ended at 4:30 in the morning. I think it's interesting to note that the adoption of this code marks the first time in 30 years that WHO has used its constitutional authority to develop a code. The last one was the 1981 Code on Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes. So although it was heralded upon its adoption by the WHO Director General as a real gift to public health everywhere, some observers have questioned the potential significance of this code and its potential impact on safe behavior, or it's been equated with the existing weak codes on health worker recruitment. It's been argued that the instrument's not legal or will have a negligible impact on state practice because it's not technically binding as a matter of international law. Well, in my view, this perspective is really quite narrow and doesn't reflect contemporary developments in international relations. You know, in the past, of course, it was widely accepted that no international law governed a subject until a treaty was created. Today, however, most recognize that formal recommendations of international organizations can at times create norms that effectively guide the behavior of states and other actors. Now, undoubtedly, there's no alternative to treaties when states want to make credible commitments. But treaties are not and cannot be the sole source of norms in the international system. Today, international politics is too dynamic and fluid to be guided exclusively by treaties that are remarkably slow and expensive to negotiate, conclude, and to bring into force. So increasingly, the challenges of global governance demand faster and more flexible approaches to international cooperation than is provided by traditional and heavily legalized strategies. So consequently, in a variety of realms, ranging from arms control to the environment, the world community is increasingly turning to the creation of non-binding solutions. And although many of these non-binding standards are purely rhetorical, they can at times create effective norms that guide the behavior of states and other actors and produce real and sustainable results. So the political and legal significance of some of these intergovernmental resolutions is captured by the idea of soft law. So the WHO could be an important new instrument for international cooperation. First of all, the WHO code is unique in scope. It provides the only global framework, though not the solution, for international cooperation. It provides a global response to a global problem. In addition, the process of developing and negotiating this code has put the concern on the global stage, and the process of implementing it will keep it high on the political agenda of WHO and its member states. And as one of our African delegates noted at the end of these negotiations, as a consequence of the code, issues that have long been under the table are now squarely on top of it. In addition, the WHO code is an important source of internationally accepted principles on standards on health workforce recruitment. Key elements of the code include the establishment of voluntary standards that honor the rights and the obligations of source states, destination states, and health personnel. The code's focus is on supporting sustainable health systems, particularly in developing countries. And to this end, many of the provisions in the code recommend that states undertake action to ensure that the international migration should have a net positive impact on developing countries. Now, to be honest, of course, substantively, the WHO Global Code is neither a perfect text, nor, unfortunately, Karen, is it a solution to the challenges of health worker migration. States continue to hold widely divergent views on some of the key aspects of a regime for international health worker recruitment. So consequently, the substantive norms that are advanced by the code remain quite broad and general. But I think it needs to be recognized that the code was never intended to be the final answer or encompass the solution to the challenges of health worker migration. Rather, the goal was to establish a platform for continuous and informed global dialogue, and indeed the code does just that. The code provides a robust and transparent framework for global governance that I believe may lead to a deepening of commitment over time. Indeed, the potent procedural and institutional mechanisms that have been incorporated in this code are, in fact, stronger than mechanisms found in a number of treaties, including the Framework Convention on Tobacco. First of all, the WHO code breaks new ground with its provision on data collection and information exchange, which Christoph has just explained to us is crucially needed, not only in the Caribbean, but worldwide, to inform policy. Among other things, the code calls upon member states to create a national focal point for information exchange. It also calls upon member states to maintain an updated database of information on health personnel migration and its impact on health systems and relevant laws, and to report this data to WHO every 3 years. The code also recommends a variety of mechanisms designed to promote implementation. Among other things, member states are called upon to maintain an updated list of authorized recruiters and, to the extent possible, monitor and regulate recruiters and employers. And there was a variety of provisions related to the provision of technical and financial support. And finally, the code develops a procedural framework designed to promote continuous national and global dialogue and action on health worker recruitment and to keep this issue on the permanent agenda of WHO. It provides that member states should report every 3 years on implementation, you know, the challenges encountered and the headway made in implementing the code to WHO starting in 2012. In turn, the Director General is supposed to report to the Health Assembly every 3 years on the effectiveness of the code starting in 2003, and the Health Assembly is to keep the code under periodic review. So through these and other measures, the code aims to establish a transparent and effective procedural structure. So although non-binding, the WHO code may therefore provide a significant first step towards the development of an effective framework for national and international cooperation. And that's the final point. The code is designed to be the first step and not the final word. As Article 11 emphasizes, the code is a dynamic instrument that should be brought up to date and that must be brought up to date as required. So this PowerPoint sets forth the timeline for this reporting framework and evidences how the new code has put the issue of health worker migration permanently and prominently on the political agenda of states at WHO. It only goes to 2019, but it can go to infinity. So since the adoption of the code last May, the HRH team in Geneva and in the regions have developed a plan to promote implementation involving four core components: communication and advocacy, partnerships, resource mobilization, and the development of guidelines. I wanted to say a few words about this strategy relating to the development of guidelines for monitoring the implementation of the WHO code. In particular, WHO drafted guidelines to assist states in fulfilling their reporting commitments under the code, the reporting both of data on health worker migration and recruitment, and also the reporting of strategies to promote implementation. These draft guidelines were launched in May at the World Health Assembly and, in fact, will be finalized next month or sometime following tomorrow. I think there's a number of interesting features about these guidelines, but for me the most interesting is that they significantly democratize global health governance at WHO, with features designed to encourage broad stakeholder participation in national implementation. The guidelines include a mechanism for non-state actor reporting, which is something really unique at WHO, and provides that all reports, whether of states or non-state actors, will be published on the WHO website. So participation of non-state actors in a reporting exercise is without precedent at WHO. And it's based upon the experience of other international legal regimes, including human rights treaties and codes developed under the auspices of other specialized agencies, including the FAO. And the goal is to establish a transparent framework for global governance that engages and empowers all relevant actors in the process. So just a bit over a year after the adoption of the code, we are beginning to see evidence how states are beginning to implement the code and then use it as a framework for national law and policy. As of this month, 69 countries had designated national authorities for information exchange, and states are beginning to report how they're implementing the code into national law and policy. Kenya and Zimbabwe have been reviewing draft legislation using the code principles, and in addition, Kenya is developing bilateral agreements on health worker recruitment using the code principles. Thailand has organized a multi-pronged strategy to promote code implementation. In addition to translating the code into Thai, it has created a national subcommission and a three-year plan of action to implement the code. And Norway has also launched a multi-pronged strategy to implementing the code. The code is now available in Norwegian. I actually wonder how many languages it's been translated into. And Norway has launched an implementation strategy, including scaling up the education of relevant health personnel in order to meet the code's goal of self-sustainability. So overall, I think the experience to date of the code evidence that this carefully crafted non-binding instrument can and should be an effective and highly flexible tool of health policy. But unfortunately, I feel the need to end my presentation on a somewhat less positive note about the potential future of the WHO code. As I'm sure most of you are aware, WHO is now undergoing a massive reform process. And at headquarters, this reforming effort has taken an enormous toll on staff and resources available to promote implementation of the code and, of course, other programs. But in my view, if we want to ensure that this code fulfills its potential as an effective instrument of international cooperation and doesn't slide into something purely rhetorical, the question of resources needs to be seriously addressed. Thank you.